Right, and we had to go in the next morning to have a procedure. And so we get there really early. It had been snowing in Portland, and if it snows an inch, everybody stays home. And it's kind of scary in there. And we get to this room where you're, like, downstairs because the surgical place wasn't open yet. We're sitting down there, and it's dark, and it's like 6:30 in the morning, and I see this guy come going like this in the windows. I'm like, oh, crud. It's Roy, right? So I duck, right, because I don't need Roy at this moment in my time. But my wife waves at Roy. Right? And I was like, man, that's not good. Here comes in Roy, and I go, Roy, what are you doing here? He goes, oh, man, this is a big deal. I came here to hang out with you guys. I thought, that's stupid. My wife thinks Roy walks on water, but that's a whole other story. When they went to take my wife back in to do the surgery, Roy looked at me, and he says, hey, we need to pray. I said, I thought you have a problem with God. He says, I have no problem with God. This is no time for my problems with God. We need to pray. And he got on his knees in that waiting room and started praying. And I was embarrassed, I was shamed, I was sweating, and I was pissed off. Right? How can you do that and embarrass me in front of these strangers when I just lost a baby? You know, and he stayed down there the whole time. And when they came back out to take us back to see my wife, people hugged Roy. People thanked him for praying. It's the finest example of Alcoholics Anonymous I've been involved with. So today I can go to a Starbucks, I can get on my knees and pray because I'm not ashamed or embarrassed of my God. Right? And that's how it was. I got into step four. You know, look, I'm the kind of guy, people say they hide their step four. I'm going to be honest with you. The reason I hid my step four from my wife is I didn't want her to add to it. Right? That's what my biggest fear was. I didn't want her to write down things I forgot about. Right? So I hid it from her. Step five, I got in. I had to share that with somebody else. Right? I had to get down. I had to share with that. And then I got to six and seven. Again, I had to get a dictionary. I got to step six. You know, and it said, I looked up in the dictionary, it said it was a shortcoming. Well, that threw me off. I looked up shortcoming, it said it's a character defect. I was like, Jesus, this has got to be the dumbest thing I've ever been involved in, right? So I went to my sponsor, I said, I don't get it. And he goes, well, Jason, here, I'm going to make it really easy for you. A character defect is when you're doing something you shouldn't be doing, like lying, stealing, cheating, gossiping, judging. I mean, he listed off everything I probably do. I said, okay. And he said, in his shortcomings, the things you're not doing. Like saying please and thank you, pushing the shopping cart back to the where you got it, holding the door open for somebody, being present, showing up for your commitments. Man, when he said those things, I got it, right? So I'm that kind of guy. I'm the kind of guy that, you know, you just, I'm baffled. I'm baffled with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I came in here and couldn't stop drinking, nor do I want to. And it says right here, when I was at step two, it says, look, I brought my glasses. I didn't bring a book or a coat. But it says right here, it says, I was having, look, I'm locked up in a cell by myself with nothing in my body. It says right here, I was having troubles with personal relationships. Obviously, I was locked up. I couldn't control my emotional natures. I was crying, laughing, crying, screaming, scared. All is there anybody else scared in here? Right? Thank you. I'm scared too. Right? I really am. And sometimes I need that. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy, and we couldn't seem to be of real help to anybody. That's who I am when I don't have alcohol in my body. And when I put alcohol in my body, something clicks and I'm an ass, right? And the people I'm the meanest to are the people that love me the most, right? The people that are going to, they're going to take me back every time. They're going to, it's okay, that's just the way he is. It's okay, that's the way he is. It's okay, that's the way he is, right? And alcohol justifies and rationalizes that. And I talked about that last night with my men's with my grandparents and how I treated my grandma, who that was. So, you know, going all the way through the first six, seven steps, look, if you're not working, this is what I was told by an old-timer, don't take it the wrong way because, look, again, I'm not the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said this last night, there's two kinds of people in AA, those who show you what to do and those who show you what not to do, and they're equally as important. And that's how I got the name, for Christ's sakes, Jason. But, you know, man, how real do I want to be, or how free do I want to be? I was told if you're not doing 6 and 7 every day, and you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're not working on 6 and 7 every day, they told me I should probably get out of AA because I'm going to screw it up, right? I think I have to be an active member in Alcoholics Anonymous. I should be working on my character defects and my shortcomings every day, right? So that's what I know today, and that's what I feel in my heart. When I got to step 8, all I had to do is become willing to make amends, make that list, right? I just had to be willing to do that. And because of doing step 4 and having that fourth column and looking at my mistakes, I had a lot of people already written down, right? And I had a lot of institutions. I had a lot of things I knew I was going to have to address. That was easy for me. But what happened for me is I got to step 9. And step 9, I have to leave my house, right? I actually have to visit you people, right? The first 8, I just have to talk to my sponsor and God and wander around, right? And for me, that was the scariest part for me, right? That was the part that I thought was going to be the, am I really the guy that I wrote down in step 4, right? Am I really that guy? And look, if you're having a problem on step 4, man, you've already lived it, right? Just write it down, you know what I mean? But for me, when I got to step 9, I really had to think. I really had to stop each one. I was told I had to list them out. I had to run them by my sponsor. To this day, he doesn't let me make amends on my own, right? Because sometimes the way I word things might put me in a deeper hole, right? I don't know if that makes sense, but sometimes they don't come out right, which then my wife has to go back and explain, and it's really good when your wife is helping you make your amends. Yeah. But you know, I do that and I invite God to go with me, right? And because of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and because of this, you know, I'm able to benefit from these things, right? It says, if you don't talk about the bedevilments, you shouldn't read the promises, in my opinion. If you don't read the promises, you should probably talk about the bedevilments. If you do the steps that are in the middle of the bedevilments and the promises, man, that's what you get. Right? That's this whole deal. This is what makes me okay to look in the mirror and be all right with myself. Right? And it says right here, it says, Jesus, I'm glad I got glasses. I didn't forget them. I did forget a big book and a suit, but that's a whole other story. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drinking would make a skeptic out of anyone. When my daughter is 7 or 8 years old, man, I'm not a good dad. There's a lot of fathers in here, right? Is there a lot of fathers in here? Is there any other fathers in here? Thank God, right? Well, I'm not father of the year, right? We heard that last night. I still lose it. But I remember my daughter and her friend Cody were over at our house going to stay the night, and they were 6 or 7 years old, and they're running around with enthusiasm for life. Man, I lost it, right? I gave them everything I had. I started yelling at them. I screamed at them, and they disappeared. I was like, huh, it worked, right? What I come to find out later, when Cody's mom showed up, is they went into a closet and called Cody's mom to come get them because they were scared of me. That's what sobriety, right? Who yells at 2 little kids that they go hide in a closet and call somebody's mom to come get me, right? You know, and my wife, I don't know, but I have a wife that's very opinionated. And she told me I need to figure this out and get it taken care of. And there's this thing called a sponsorship meeting in my thing. And we meet once a month. All the guys in my sponsorship line, and all the, yeah, there's way too many people. But the meeting is one of those meetings where you share and then everybody can give you feedback, which sucks, right? I'm a firm believer in no crosstalk, right? I'm a firm believer, right? Whew. Well, I had to bring up my incident of what happened at my house. And, you know, and look, I had gone through the steps, I thought, right? I did the best I could. I've gone through the steps many a times. And so I go to this meeting and I share with these guys. I said, man, I don't know how to be a dad. I'm not a really good dad. I scream at my kids and my wife. I yell at everybody. I want to kill you or me or them at any time, right? It could happen. I don't know what sets me off. I don't know what to do. And here it comes, right? This one guy, Larry, who I can't stand, right? He raises his hand. He goes, can I say something? And yeah, what do you got? He goes, man, Jason, I know what you do. I go, what's that, Larry? He goes, man, every time we go to an AA event, the first thing my kids ask is Jason going to be there? Because when you see him, you hug him, you make sure they're entertained, and you make sure they're fed. So why don't you start treating your daughter like you're babysitting my kids when you're having problems? I said, that's stupid. It'll never work. So I started doing it, right? My daughter's 13 years old, and she has a slumber party. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning, and my wife wakes me up. She says, you need to get in there and go tell them to be quiet. They're making too much noise. I told my wife I didn't invite them. Actually, I was sleeping just fine, right? Yeah, that didn't go real well. So now I'm up and I'm mad, and I walk in, I open the room, and I open the door, and they're just like, whatever 13-year-old girls do with phones and bouncing around, and TV's blaring, and radio's on, everything. Yeah. And I gave it to them. Oh, man, I gave it to them, right? And I yelled at them. I called them what I told them what I thought, and blah, blah, blah. And I shut the lights off. I told them to go to bed, and I slammed that door, and I went back, and I was laying in my bed, and I could hear Larry's voice saying, you better go take care of that. Is that the way you treat anybody's kids? That might be the only example of Alcoholics Anonymous or a father some of those girls might see. Man, you guys screwed me up, right? So I get up, and the dog and I go back, right? And we open up the door, and I turn on the light, and they're all just staring at me, right? And I said, man, I'm sorry for yelling at all you guys. What you guys need to do is you need to turn the lights down, turn the TV down, and start like you calm down a little bit because you're making Julie really mad, right? We all laughed. But this is the program of the Alcoholics Anonymous. This is doing a step, right? When I went to shut that door, my daughter's friend Cody said, I told you guys he would come back and apologize. That's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the steps, right? I'm not looking at, look, I didn't go to my dope dealer and say, hey, sorry, I robbed you, right? I won't do that again. Here's your money. Nah. Mine's my family, right? Mine's my family. That's where I have to go. That's where I have to be. So when I got into the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and I worked through this process over and over and over, I get to step 9 and I get the rest of this thing, right? It says right here, now I know why we use books. There may be some wrongs we cannot never fully right, but don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter, and there may be a valid reason for the postponement of these cases. The postponement, that's one thing that they make me underline, right? Doesn't mean I'm getting out of it, right? Because, again, I'm a loophole guy. I don't want to go there because it might not go my way. But when I do these things, this is what happens. We delay. It says, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we're halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom, a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor we wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, sorry, I didn't mean to look at you like that. But you ruined my bank robber story, right? You got me. We will say, shit. Trying to be a smartass, and I got to start all over. Sorry, Marilyn. That took up a couple minutes anyway, right? I still got 20 minutes. All right, we're going to get back to these, right? I'm going to tell you one more story, maybe two. When I got locked up, right, there was a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's a great guy. His name's Randy, right? Randy's the kind of guy when I met him, he had one daughter in college, two daughters in high school, and he has a boy with special needs, right? And Randy's that kind of guy that just does anything for anybody, right? And when you're drinking and using and you're doing what I do and you're on the run, you take advantage of people like that, right? And I remember somehow, some way, I ended up borrowing $3,000 from Randy. And, he would call me on the phone and I would hang up and he'd call and leave messages like, I hope you find your way back to the ruins of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope you find a God. I mean, stuff that's very annoying when you're trying to be a drug dealer, right? you're in the middle of work, and I guess kind of work, huh? And people are calling. You kept calling and kept calling and kept calling. And I avoided that guy with everything I had, right? I avoided him because I was embarrassed. I avoided him because I had shame, right? I don't know if anybody is in here has ever owed anybody money, right? It sucks, especially when you don't have any to pay it back. And I get locked up, right? And I made that decision. I turned my will and my life over to the care of God, and I'm in this cell. And I got moved into population. And when I got moved into the population, I finally got a visit, right? And I thought maybe it was my wife, ex-wife, bringing me my kids, my daughter to see. I thought it might be one of my uncles or my attorney. I didn't know what it was going to be, right? And like my convict friend over here, I was in one of those rooms with the glass and the phone, right? And it's like a closet, right? It's not like not like TV, right? And I walk in here, and they put you in this closet, and I sit down, and all of a sudden, here comes Randy. Whoa, that sucks, right? I'm going to tell you right now, that's a bad feeling when you owe a guy money, and you're stuck in a closet for 20 minutes with him. And, you know, I did what you guys taught me to do. I invited God to go with me, right? And I sat there, and he sat down, and the first thing I said is, man, Randy, I'm sorry for stealing that money from you. When I get out of here, I'll pay you back. This man was doing the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. He lives a program. He's a spiritual man. He says to me, Jason, I'm not here for your money. I'm here to tell you I love you. And I'm also here to tell you that I forgive you. And I was like, I was kind of taken back, right? I didn't know I'd do this. But it was right before Christmas. And he said to me, he goes, my wife and my kids have came to me, and they've given me all their Christmas money, and they would like to buy Julie and Bailey something from you for Christmas. And it changed my life just like that, right? Changed me just like that. Because what I saw is I was able to witness somebody that I had stole from and cheated and lied to, and they forgave me. I didn't think people did that, right? Today, when I've loaned somebody money, I don't have any expectations. If I don't have any expectations, I don't get into drama, you know? And that, in a nutshell, is what 8 and 9 is for me. That's a daily thing, right? And for me, you know, it says in here, I'll finish reading it, although I probably need another story to keep up. Where am I at, Jason? Like, I'm done? He's like, you're out of here. Way to make me feel comfortable. We'll start it. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see our experiences can benefit others. The feeling of usefulness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. If you're new here, you're wanted, welcome, and needed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope that you find somebody, or I hope you find a group that believes in you, right? And allows you to take the journey of Alcoholics Anonymous and go through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous so that you can get through step 9 and do this, right? Everything I have in my life, it's a value or any good. Anything I'm going to be that has any value, here comes Lee. Oh, I thought I was in trouble. Is that out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Step 9 is what made me a member of the community. Step 9 is what's made me a member of my family. Right? That's the buzz. That's the buzz. There's this guy, I want to share this. There's this guy, Joe. He's from Cincinnati, right? I don't know if he's in here. He might. But look, I met this guy. I heard this guy in 1999 at a conference. I was brand new. I was sitting, or maybe it was 1980, I was sitting in a seat in the back like at a thing like this, and that guy told his story, and it moved me, right? And I remember thinking to myself, if I could ever share with somebody and have them feel the way that he made me feel at that conference, that's the buzz. That's what I get from step 9. Now, Marilyn's going to come up here and clean this whole mess up. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Marilyn. I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety date, February 8th, 1972. I am very old. In fact, you might say I'm in God's waiting room. But while I'm here, I enjoy life very, very much. And it is such a pleasure to be here. I've heard about this conference for a long time. It's kind of the creme de la creme. And it's not only lived up to expectations, it's surpassed them. So thank you. Thank you, Star, and all the committee and everybody else involved in this, all the other speakers. I really am here just because I drank way too much, way too often. And at first, it was the blessing in my life, but it brought me to that state that's described on page 27 in our big book, that confrontation between Carl Jung and Groland. And Carl Jung had to explain to him, you're a hopeless alcoholic. He had helped him. He stayed sober while he was with the great psychiatrist, but he went back to the States, started drinking himself to death again, went back to see Dr. Jung. Dr. Jung said that I've been trying to produce some kind of spiritual experience in you that will cause a conversion, that will allow you to stay sober. But in cases like you, alcoholics, I just fear the worst. I think you're hopeless. Well, you don't want to hear that from your doctor or psychiatrist, but that's what he had to live with. But he went home and he found the Oxford group, a precursor to our program, and in fact did have that conversion experience and never drank again, lived for many years after that. And I got to that state of hopelessness. And for me, I think it was most manifest at 3 o'clock in the morning. At first I would wake up and say, you know, I'm not going to drink tomorrow. And then that turned into, you know, I am going to drink tomorrow and the day after and the day after, and I'm going to die of alcoholism and there's no hope for me. And then, luckily, I had that surrender that I think everybody in this room has had. I have a wonderful sponsor who gives out gifts. He says, you fought the war, and you lost. Admit it. And that's not sufficient, but we have the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, this outgrowth of many, many religious traditions and the Oxford group. And it is through these steps, along with the fellowship, enormous help of a higher power, that we can come to some kind of state where we don't have to drink ourselves to death anymore. Hopelessness, surrender, and that conversion experience. And sometimes it's sudden, as Bill Wilson had, sometimes it's the educational variety, but we are changed, we are transformed to the place where we don't have to drink anymore. And then that thirst for alcohol becomes a thirst for somehow, some way, carrying this message of recovery to alcoholics who still suffer. Carl Jung summed it up as spiritus contra spiritum. Spirits are like alcohol. And they also refer to higher power, the spirit of the universe. And that spirit, higher power, God as we understand God, can work against the spirits, alcohol, so that we don't have to drink anymore. But it means, first I used to think of steps 10, 11, 12 as maintenance steps, but it was pointed out to me by the big book, in fact, that those are our growth steps. We don't do steps 1 through 9, and then we just stay that same way forever. I did steps 1 through 9, and as a result of that, I did have that conversion experience, that spiritual awakening, and for me, that was fairly sudden. I couldn't see, and then the veil parted, and it was, ah, you've been there all along, haven't you? Fairly sudden. So I just thought, I'm going to coast for the rest of my life, and that's it. I know there's a higher power there. Little did I know that changed. And that I think, is this experience that we have that Buddhism talks about. Now, I'm not a Buddhist, so I probably am all wrong, but there is this saying, if you find the Buddha on the road, kill him. Now, we're not violent folks. There was laughter there. I worry about you. But my friend Diana, who is a Buddhist, said that really means that, you know, you just think you have some grasp on higher power. You understand what this is all about. And then that gets dashed to earth. You don't kill it necessarily. It's killed for you. And a whole new belief system starts. As I said, I've lived a long time. This program's kept me sober for over 50 years. And so I have had several experiences of loss of faith and recovery of that. And in order to maintain this process so that I do stay sober, so that there is this growth, this change, the loss of faith, the recovery of faith, I've had to practice these last 3 steps. This step 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when wrong, promptly admitted it. That was a real surprise to me, because I realized after taking the first 9 steps, I've cleaned the slate. I mean, I wrote a searching and fearless moral inventory of my mother-in-law, and then finally 2 more where I had to do exactly what Megan was talking about, take the big book seriously and look at what I've done and what I have to clean up. So, and likewise with 6 and 7, through that inventory process, I came to know that I am really a flawed human being, but there is a higher power, the higher power that I discovered. And that higher power can remove all these defects of character, and how wonderful that is. So now I won't have them anymore. And was I ever surprised? One of the surprises was I have made amends. That was painful in many cases. It took courage to do that. As Jason said, you have to go out and knock on somebody's door and encounter the real world. So I just decided I'm not going to harm anybody again, because I don't want to have to make amends for it. That didn't work. One painful incident was some time ago, about 20 years ago, in fact. I was at the wedding of our son David, and older sister Becky was there with her fairly new husband. And I learned that he wanted to leave before the wedding pictures were taken. He had to go play music at somebody else's wedding. So I went over and I scolded him. I mean, that's what a mother-in-law does, right? You know, you have to, if you're going to be in somebody's wedding, you have to be there for the whole day. How could you make a plan? And he just kind of walked away looking sad. Well, he talked to Becky, his wife, my daughter, and I explained about the scolding and mean mother-in-law. And Becky stopped talking to me for about 6 months. Well, I felt sad about that. Apparently, I had not minded page 21 in our 12 and 12, which warns us about restraint of tongue and pen. You don't give people scoldings unless you want to have the consequences. Dr. Bob, in that farewell talk, said many wonderful things in a short time, but he mentioned that erring member, the tongue. And let's be kind to other people. Let's be patient. Kindness, patience, tolerance, consideration. And I hadn't done that. So I applied our principle. I made a great apology. Please forgive me. I am so sorry for what I did to husband and to daughter Becky. And Becky's attitude was, I don't want to talk about it because I might say things I regret. And she just shut me out for a long period of time. I felt so bad that I had to turn to my sponsor and friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they just said, keep the door open, which I did. I sent cards. Every now and then I'd leave a message. I love you very much. The door is always open. And one day after many months, she was ready to come through that door. And we made up, and that's not happened again. And I've tried to be more careful. But I can be sarcastic, I can be flippant, but that's what this step 10 is for. We get another chance, a second chance, third chance, 100th chance in Alcoholics Anonymous if we live long enough. And this 10th step cleans the slate. It cleans off the viewer so that we can begin to recover that conscious contact with higher power when we lose it through harming others, through character defects. And that implies our step 11, having sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. That's a wonderful, wonderful step in all kinds of ways. And one is that line that God added, God as you understood him, just a reminder of our tradition that says we're all welcome. Anybody with the desire to stop drinking can be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the early days, there was much bitterness and fighting. It's just amazing that our fellowship survived, given the clientele. I mean, it was formed by alcoholics. I mean, if you ever doubt that there's a higher power, just look at that. And so they fought over this. Bill Wilson had experience with Ebby, who was sober in the Oxford group, a Christian group, very religious. And so he wanted to emphasize the spiritual nature, and he had that big white light experience. That was very important to him, but there were other people like Hank Parkhurst, an early member who sadly got drunk by 1940, Clarence Snyder, Jim Burwell, that were saying we've got to emphasize the steps, the recovery part of the program. People don't want to hear about God when they come in. That scares them away. So it was a battle. So it was finally compromised. And the phrase, God as we understood God, synonyms for God are used a lot in the big book, making it safe for people like me who came into the program as an atheist. That as several people have mentioned, God was kind of scary. It represented a kind of religion back in Ohio where I just thought, these people are crazy. So, God as you understood him, and it could be anything. One person said God was his salamander. Well, okay, anything goes on this program. And so I began to be a seeker and try to improve that conscious contact with God. And I just found that was not going to do anything quickly for me. And so I got kind of impatient, and I didn't realize at the time that God is really doing so much of the work, and I can't force that kind of thing. I can sit and say, God, appear before me. I want a white light experience, and I can do that 24 hours a day, day after day after day. And that somehow does not work. And my first transition was, I have to replace God as Santa Claus with some better understanding of God. I can't make God appear on the spot, nor can I make God find me a parking place. I thought I could, but several failures at that made me rethink that whole thing. And as I said, there have been crises of faith. I had a beloved sponsee, Sally, who was a social worker, and she loved art, and her great goal was somehow, some way, to be an art historian. And I loved her because she was able to go to graduate school and study art history. And she lived far away, but she would come to Los Angeles, and she was my own personal guide in museums. And we went to the Huntington Gallery, all of these great galleries in Los Angeles, the Getty Museum, and she could explain all these great artworks. And I just kept reminding her of God in a painting, God in your life. God made it possible for her to go to graduate school. God made it possible for her to come and be my guide in a museum. Isn't God wonderful? And we began to appreciate the goodness of God, just sitting back, letting God be God, not trying to force it. And it was such a wonderful experience. She longed for even more, and she wanted to teach art history. And lo and behold, she got a postdoctoral fellowship, which every academic wants on an academic career. And it was, see how God is working in your life. It was just sitting back and allowing it to happen. And we were amazed and delighted. And then, the best of all, she got the offer of a tenure-track position in a good university. She was going to be a professor. And we just celebrated God's goodness. And then she had a pain in her side, and she went to the doctor, and the doctor used the word mass. And it turned out to be stage 4 pancreatic cancer. And my faith was shattered. I couldn't say, see how God is working in your life? It didn't make sense anymore to me. And I lost my faith, and I sadly could not support Sally. Luckily, she was in a community where she found the support she needed, and she handled it so much better than I did. And I tried to look to that example, and I couldn't. And it was my own daughter who rescued me, strangely. She said, remember when we were small, Dad used to read Winnie the Pooh to us, and there was a special story. Now, my daughter has had the kind of career that it seems Sally was on. She went to graduate school, did a postdoc, and she is a professor of immunology, and enjoys that very much, I thought, until she pointed out that, remember that Winnie the Pooh story where Winnie the Pooh says to Piglet, Piglet says to Winnie the Pooh, what is your favorite thing? And Winnie the Pooh said, eating honey. And then he thought about it and he said, no, it's that moment before eating honey. Just that moment. And Susie pointed out that Sally had that moment, that special moment before eating the honey, offered that tenure-track position in the university. Susie's on that path. She took that position, and she has angry students who want an A-minus instead of a B-plus, and how dare you, arguments in faculty committees. There's that saying, why are academic politics so vicious? That's because the stakes are so terribly small. And Sally was spared all of that. She had that wonderful moment, that moment of anticipation. And somehow that story, talking to Susie, changed it all for me. And I had a whole new relationship with a higher power, just as our 11th step tells us to do, seek through prayer and meditation, listen to others, more will be revealed. And now I see a long life is not necessarily better or worse than a short life. I believe that we're here as long as we need to be here to learn the spiritual lessons we're supposed to learn. As our 12 and 12 mentioned someplace, we'll be fine here and in the hereafter. My whole mind, my whole consciousness opened up to a much bigger, much more complex, higher power. I can never, ever understand what we're dealing with. It's way too complex. Look at the size of the universe. Look at the complexity of living things. Gives me an appreciation for what we're dealing with. But more than that, I just look at you. And how in the world could you be sober, given where you come from? I mean, jail. I came from a garage. And yet we take up our beds and walk. And we experience that conversion that Carl Jung so wanted to produce in Roland. And when we go through those steps of hopelessness, surrender, conversion, then our obligation, our thirst, that is what we're here for, as our fifth tradition says, that every group's primary purpose is to carry the message of recovery to alcoholics. That is our purpose. And as long as we observe that, somehow there is that constant feeding of whatever we need to stay sober, to allow this growth, this recovery, to keep happening. I'm in the Pacific group in West Los Angeles. It's this big, active group. And how do we practice this 12th step? Well, I'm a great believer in community. I think that if you're a loner, let's say you're on a desert island and there are seven people there and one of them is drinking him or herself to death, you can probably get that person to understand the message by telling your story. If you have a big book, you can read the big book together. It might work, but I think that it's so much more effective, so much easier if you're in a group that honors the traditions and believes in the strong sponsorship ethic, so that when a newcomer wanders in, you can just pick that newcomer up and throw that newcomer into the river of sobriety and say, swim, just do what everybody else is doing. And that person gets carried along by the current. But it's also important one-on-one. If you're lucky enough to get a sponsee, to get a newcomer, it's so rewarding to sit down, read our literature together, the big book and the 12 and 12. Say, these are the steps that we take. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, the result of these steps, I'm carrying this message to you. This is the way I stay sober. And that person then begins to understand that this is a gift, but it also is a gift that has to be given in order for that gift to persist. And in our meeting, there's a wonderful person who just passed away, Father Terry R. in Los Angeles. He says that sometimes the first glimpse of a higher power is that smile a greeter gives you when you walk into your first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you walk in, and then there's God in a cup of coffee. The person begins to see goodness, and it turns into godness, godliness. And so I'm a strong believer in community and the importance of that. Certainly strong sponsorship. I've had a sponsor for many years. My sponsor of 30 years passed away 2 years ago, but right away I got another sponsor because I need that. In fact, I texted my sponsor thinking, how in the world can I talk about steps 10, 11, 12? I mean, they're so vast. And he said, well, why don't you just announce that you're in favor of them? Good idea. Another thing that I want to mention is there was a fellow a long time ago, Keith C., that used to say, God, help me to accept the seemingly good and the seemingly bad as necessary for my growth and recovery in this fellowship. And one of the things that was seemingly bad was this pandemic that struck all of us, that we lost 5 members in our home group to COVID before the vaccines were developed. And that was seemingly bad. But through that, we have begun to have virtual meetings that's connected us as never before. And one of the great advantages in our home group is that there is a person who was born in Japan who made trips back quite often because of family, whom I happen to sponsor. It's a great privilege to sponsor her. And she felt sad that her Japanese friends in Japan did not have the experience that we have in the States. Southern California has very, very strong AA, and she would like to introduce that. And here we have these virtual meetings, and we started out a little meeting at the beginning of the pandemic of 5 people. And I'm always trying to learn Japanese. I'm fascinated by that country, and I asked her if I could come to the meeting. And they were speaking Japanese, I mean, 5 Japanese people from Southern California. And great politeness prevailed, so they began to translate for me. And I was embarrassed by that, but loved it. Well, this meeting went on with translation, and pretty soon some more people began to come. And then people began to come from Japan as they heard about it, and they began to sign on. And now we have a meeting every Tuesday night with about 100 people signing on from Japan. We have, because of Yuko and her great language ability, simultaneous translation, which you can do with some of the virtual programs. We don't endorse products, but it starts with Z. And so we've had this lovely, lovely outreach. And all of these people in Japan are getting so enthusiastic about it. These 4 steps, conversion, and then you have this desire to tell other people about it, which they are doing. And they're using some of the formats from our home group, the Pacific group. So they've started Tokyo Pacific group. And I'm going to Japan in March. And I'm going to meet them in person. I know them already virtually. And I cannot wait. I still try to learn Japanese, but I'm not very good at it. So I'm just going to say one word. Well, I'll say a couple of words to all of you. Arigato gozaimasu. Thank you. And now I'll say, sayonara.